I'm Laura.
And I'm Georgiana.
And this is De Canterbury Tales. Good evening.
Good evening.
It will be morning when people probably listen to this. So good
morning.
Good morning
to you.
Good morrow.
Whatever time it is, good whatever time it is to you.
Yes. Good day.
Good day.
Oh, this is De Canterbury Tales, a boozy book club podcast.
Where we interview authors, winemakers. No, we've been a little light on the winemaker. Sorry, y'all. And talk about books, make it more accessible.
That's our thing. That's our spiel. Today's episode is a boozy book club episode. We are talking about
All the Dangerous Things by Stacey Willingham.
Yes, which is exciting. Have her back.
Oh yeah, she's our first two-peat, and loved having her. Yeah, repeat, two-peat, three-peat, you know, I'm going with two-peat. I'm trying to make it a thing.
Let me roll. Okay, I'm sorry.
She's harshing my mellow, y'all. Name that movie.
Oh, no, I don't know. Wait, I do know this.
God, Mrs. Something, I was in the middle of a power jam. You're totally harshing my mellow.
I don't get it.
It's a Cinderella story.
Dang! It's been a minute. Gonna have to rewatch.
Before
we dive in, we banter. So we're now at the banter part real quick.
Well, I think it's been a little bit more of an active month for me than January was. But I went home for Mardi Gras. Hail Iris. I ride in an all women's parade every year. This was about my 10th year riding. And so that's always fun. I rode with my friend Mignon and Tara, who's like my friend cousin, one of those weird people.
A friend cousin.
Yeah. You know, the line is blurred. It's very difficult to describe. But we had a lot of fun. I went to an engagement party while I was there. That was also nice. So in honor of Mardi Gras, I have only read, minus like one book, Purple, Green, and Gold books. So the reason you didn't get a January read cap is I didn't have enough Purple, Green, and Gold. So you'll get a dual January, February read cap photo in Purple, Green, and Gold because it's all about the aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. Which is merch. We got merch. It's a sticker, y'all.
So. It's a sticker, so it's a real thing. I'm living by the sticker.
The sticker.
Then I recently, like yesterday, went to an event put on by Main Street Reads in Somerville, South Carolina. And it was a Q&A with Grady Hendrix, who we had on for our second episode for Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires. And then Stacey Willingham, All the Dangerous Things. And we also had her on for Flicker in the Dark. And so Grady's new book is How to Sell a Haunted House. So I have signed books from both of them. And it was really interesting hearing them kind of banter back and forth between thriller and horror and inspiration and storytelling and the importance of libraries. Go libraries. I met two fabulous librarians in the line waiting for my books to get signed.
I love that.
Libraries, y'all. You don't have to buy these books. We talk about how book habits are expensive. But really enjoyed that event with Main Street Reads. And seeing Stacey and Grady again. And Grady did say he wants to come back on. So
maybe season three is the season of like, we just get people back on the show.
And we just want to talk to.
We're like, we still like you. So come on back. Come on. We already got your email address.
Work smarter, not harder.
Absolutely.
What's been going on with you?
So of all the things, the first thing I wrote on my list was I took a floral arrangement class, which was actually really fun. It was like a girls' night out, Valentine's Day thing. And so with Bellini Blooms, which is their also their Instagram handle, they do like really, really pretty. They're known for like the English garden floral arrangements, which are the really lush, really full arrangements that you see kind of on Instagram all the time.
Right.
So I learned to make those, which made me feel really great. I sent you like all the pictures of all the flower arrangements that I did.
And guys, y'all will see them. I told her to zoom in because it'll be a really good background for something at some point. So you'll see it and you can thank me later.
Yep. And then we had the Best Dressed Jackson reveal event. So I can officially talk about it out loud. I was nominated and chosen. I'm an honoree for Best Dressed Jackson, which is a fundraiser for the American Cancer Society here in Mississippi, which they provide, specifically this one provides a lot of patient care and funding for families, specifically for housing to help them stay together while patients are receiving treatment. So if you want to hear about that, it's on my social media. You can find it. I hosted a Mardi Gras party at a local restaurant called La Cour, and we raised $700 for the American Cancer Society just by drinking alcohol. Hooray.
Our favorite ways to raise money.
Absolutely. We had our big like Valentine's Day event at work, which was cool. We built like this big enormous Barbie box that people could stand in. That's like branded. I was very proud of it. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Natchez, Mississippi for the Natchez Literary and Cinema Celebration, which if you follow us on social, you saw that I was alone.
And I sincerely apologize. A fever got in my way. And
I need to be traveling sick.
No. So it was for the betterment of the people on the airplane.
Responsible.
And Jackson or Natchez, excuse me.
So, and it was beautiful. So thank you so much to the Natchez Literary and Cinema Celebration. I primarily was in the vendor alley or art alley. So I did not really get to sit in on any of the talks, but there were some really cool authors there. But in the vendor alley, there are two people I wanted to shout out because they are doing really incredible work. The first one is Jennifer from the Lantern Project. She's a librarian at Mississippi State. And her project digitizes the historical records of enslaved peoples. And so what that means is not only if you're doing research on specific, you know, areas of the South that involves enslaved peoples, it's now digitized. So if you're searching for something specific, you can find it very quickly instead of having to like just click through pages and pages of like old manuscripts. So it's not just scanned, it's fully digitized. But what it also does is it helps people trace their lineage down to like the census of like 1860 or something. Like it's able to help people like trace where they came from. So it's super important, really dark, but she is also really funny and talks about mental health. And so we were joking a lot about how what she works with is so heavy and difficult, you know, going through like the will of a slave owner and like the very last line is people. Mm. It's just like so heavy. And they have birth records and death records and all that. So she's specifically working on digitizing those so people can find it. And it's easier to find. It's searchable on the internet now.
Amazing.
So that is work. Project super, super cool. Shout out to Jennifer. She was my neighbor and we talked a lot about books and spicy fairy books and so Court of Thorns and Roses, obviously. We just, you know, just giggled a lot and made jokes. And then also next to me on the other side was Corinne from Read at the Park or Reading at the Park. They purchase and deliver books to underserved neighborhoods in Mississippi, particularly for the ready to read age for kindergarten. She had this really great presentation, but it was like more, I think it's 75% of kindergartners in Mississippi are not ready to read when they're supposed to be. And so their thing is that they get assigned to neighborhoods, specifically at parks. And so they have a designated time where families can come or just the kids can come and get books and like literally put books for free in the hands of children. So it's just really cool to be kind of around. And I was like, I'm a Books and Wine podcast.
Yeah. I've been just like sitting here thinking about digitizing the records of enslaved people and giving books to children in the park, and they're sitting in the middle. Be like, I like to read and drink wine. That's it.
Comic relief.
comic relief, yeah.
They were all great. Came away with a lot of book recommendations. So that'll be on the blog somewhere. And yes, and then the day after tomorrow, I leave for Los Angeles. Then I go to Disneyland. Then I'm home for 5 days. And then I go to Orange Beach, Alabama. And I did some math. And somehow, I am only in my actual office for 9 days at my job, my real job, from February 22nd to March 22nd. I'm only physically in the building for 9 days.
That's lovely.
I'm living the dream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I will.
4 days.
Hmm?
And I'm only using 7 of my PTO days.
Well, that's lovely.
No.
Yeah. And I'm going to Grand Cayman. So Laura and I are going to get hopefully a lot of reading done in this travel time. And hopefully we'll be really tan.
Mm.
Not that you see us, but like maybe you'll hear it in our voice that we're tan.
Hear it that we're tan. I love yeah. that.
Just the confidence that a tan gives you. It's freaking true. And don't discredit that. Everybody looks better with a little bit of a tan, and you feel better about yourself with a little bit of a tan, and that comes off in vibe.
Okay, I'll give it to you. So with all this travel we're about to do, what right now are you reading, watching, and listening to?
I am currently reading Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir. Thank you for the recommendation, Paige. Yes, I'm finally reading it. And I just finished The It Girl by Ruth Ware a little bit ago. That was really good. That was a fun kind of thriller. And then I'm really loving Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir. It's unlike anything that we've read here on the podcast that probably I've read either. Highly recommend. It's very good. Been watching Man in the High Castle, finally made it to season 4, How I Met Your Father season 2, and then I am watching You season 4. Don't spoil it, I only have one episode of season 4 left. And then I tried to, you know, get on the Oscar SAG award train thing, and I tried to watch Babylon because it's Brad Pitt and Margot Robbie, so we must. It is a 3-hour movie.
So
long. And there's so much cocaine in those 2 hours that I watched. And
there's so much. Would you say there's so much cocaine?
Yes, so much cocaine in the 2 hours that I watched. I was just like, oh my God, this is exhausting. So I only watched the first 2 hours. Sorry. I would really like to finish it, but maybe not. I don't know. And then listening to Smartless, obviously, because I love Smartless. Then I've taken a little, not a break, but I have inserted new things into my listening. It being SZA's new album, SOS. Kill Bill is awesome. And then I don't know if we have discussed how amazing Flowers is by Miley Cyrus. I don't know if we,
I have kind of burned myself out on it already, but I love it.
I love it. Honestly, like I love my relationship. I love that I am not single, but damn, wouldn't that be such a vibe if you were a single girl out in the world? I can buy myself flowers.
Was something that I think a lot of people needed for a minute. I was like, okay, cool. And it came out right before Valentine's Day. So everyone's posts were like, I don't need a man. I was like, I don't need one, but I really like mine.
Yeah, so I'll keep mine, but like, I can love me.
I can really, also really well. Love flowers.
I can write my name on the sand, in the sand.
I bought myself a lot of flowers.
So shout out to Miley Cyrus for just making a jam.
A banger again.
Bangers part two.
I was like, please catch my little music reference there.
Hey, and I know so many, that was when like she really kind of like went crazy. I put that in air quotes, y'all. And some the people really didn't. Yeah, people really didn't like bangers and her riding down a tongue slide. And I was into it. I loved it. Bangers was a hit.
I was pro bangers. I joke that bangers happen and Miley Cyrus got a lot of clap back from it. And then the Malibu album happened and she like, everyone was like, oh, she's okay now. And then Taylor Swift did her Reputation album. And I was like, so did Taylor Swift just like snatch the Miley vibes away from, they like swapped personalities for a second. And I was like, what has happened?
Yeah.
But yeah. And I love both of those albums immensely.
Immensely.
Bangers. Anyway, now I'm gonna have to go listen to that later. I'm gonna go that's gonna be on my running playlist now. I'm gonna do my thing.
It's such a winner.
Oh man.
And so what are you reading, watching, listening to?
Okay.
Distracted by Miley.
Where are we? I just finished Love in the Time of Serial Killers by Alicia Thompson. And it was very good. If you're looking for a romance that is not super typical subject matter, I really enjoyed it. I am 40% through How to Fall Out of Love Madly by Jana Casale. Don't know. But I am 40% of the way through that. And honestly, it's not bad. It's just not what I wanted to read. And it is very well written. I'm just kind of like slowly working my way through it. So it's just a different pace than what I was wanting at the time. And I am swiftly working my way through The Bartender's Cure by Wesley Stratton. I'm very much so enjoying that. It's a short little book, but it has like a ton of like, even like every chapter begins with a recipe for a cocktail, like a classic cocktail. That is then like somehow woven into the fiction, which is really cool. So you also get like a ton of alcohol, like a bunch of cocktail recipes while you read the book. So very cool. And the cover is really cute. It's sitting on my feet, so I'm showing it to you. But like, I also really like the cover.
Yeah, no, that's really cute.
It's fun. And of course I like all my little annotation flags. I like color coordinated. My highlighting in here is green to go with the neon. But yeah, so that's what I'm reading is Bartender's Cure by Wesley Stratton. And I am watching lots of yoga videos. I'm really trying to finish up. I'm trying to finish up my 200-hour yoga teacher training. So a lot of my free time is going to just like watching those to get those under my belt so that I can take my final exam. I'm also watching The Last of Us on HBO, which is incredibly good.
Yeah, Alex is watching that religiously and I pop in here or there, but I was there for the Nick Offerman and the Murray Bartlett episode.
Yes.
And, oh my God, that was just.
Which is it's almost like its whole own standalone like movie.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of fills in a bunch of backstory stuff. It doesn't really play like a major role in the actual plot, but
it was just a gorgeous bit of cinema.
Yeah, it was beautiful. So really enjoying that. Listening to Taylor Swift Midnights, obviously. Still listening to Lizzo, still listening to That's Mess Up, and I have gone back to My Favorite Murder. I've been like cycling through some of their episodes from time to time. But that is what reading, watching, and listening to. Shall we dive into wine or the alcoholic component of our episode? I have two things to talk about.
Well, let's do it.
Let's do it. So in this book, we finally get an author gives us an actual varietal. If you're reading and part of the podcast, it is so difficult to get an actual varietal in books. They'll say a red, a white, champagne or bubbles or rosé. Rosé is really the closest you'll get to like an actual varietal. But we finally have a varietal. So in one of the pivotal kind of meetup scenes, our leading lady sits down and orders a glass of Sincère. So hooray, Sincère. And so I did a little bit of a deep dive. If you are looking for a Sincère, I have now been to 3 different liquor stores to try to get one. They are exceptionally difficult to find right now due to just product. It is specifically French. You can only make a French Sincère. So because it is regional, the same way champagne is. So it is a French Sauvignon Blanc. Sincère is the region that it is from. So there is a like a product issue, and it's very, very difficult to get right now. There was one in our local liquor store that was not great. It is a little bit pricier. Sincère is going to, you know, put you, you can get a cheaper one, but you're going to be in the $25 to $30 range for a decent bottle. But here is some background on Sincère. Sincère is the region of which this French Sauvignon Blanc comes from. Sincère is known for its flinty, savory Sauvignon Blanc from the Loire Valley of France. The small town of Sincère appears as the archetypal bucolic French village, situated almost precisely in the middle of the country. And perhaps because of this, Sincère has been the center of French resistance since the Middle Ages. Huguenots retreated to it during the Wars of Religion.
Pause.
And the Reformation.
Huguenots.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
What she said. Again, during the French Revolution, the village was a center of the Royalist Rebellion to restore the French monarchy. During World War II, Sincère was a regional command center for the French resistance. After all of this, one can conclude that Sincère takes being French very seriously. And I'll, by the way, I'm getting my notes from winefolly.com, totalwine.com, and Wikipedia, just so you know. The tasting notes for Sincère wine are very, very large and varied, very varied. So kind of depending on which area of Sincère, the region, you're getting it from. These often include grass, chive, anise, chamomile. So very bitter. Thyme, honeysuckle, lime, lime peel, Meyer lemon, pink grapefruit. So you're getting a lot of that tartness. So like bitter, tart, quince, gooseberry, green apple, and pear. So we're still kind of staying in that like tart and bright fruit level. Some of them will kind of get down into a honeydew melon or a white peach, which is still a more tart level. You're not getting like a jammy or like a really fruit heavy. As well as flint, straw, gray salt, and smoke. There's a lot of stuff going on. Mm-hmm. Villages in Sincère are known for what they call goat cheese buttons. So there's a lot of goats in this area, and they make goat cheese, and they roll it into like these smaller buttons that are then aged, and they get a smoky, nutty flavor to them. So that obviously is a fantastic pairing with the Sincère wine. Overall, Sincère pairs well with a meal and can hold its own with big, bold flavors. My recommendation is if you're at a restaurant that is offering Sincère by the glass, from it's French, period, should be French. It really can't be a Sincère and not be from France. So that's not really like a tip, but if it's there, order it by the glass and see if you like it. That's like kind of a low stakes way to see if you enjoy it. Cause I'd hate to like invest in a $30 bottle of wine and not enjoy it. And the one that is at our local liquor store right now, to me, tastes a little bit more oaky and a little bit more like a Chardonnay than it does a Sauvignon Blanc. And it's not pulling through some of those more tart flavors that I personally enjoy. So learning kind of which varietal or which version of the Sincère, what winery you like it from, it's a really easy way to do that at a restaurant. So go to your local restaurant.
You know where we need to go to do that?
Where?
Chez De La Chaise.
Yes, that would be underneath, very fun.
Underneath the lights with a little charcuterie board. A charcuterie board and... some of those like duck confit wings.
Sorry. Did you, y'all, she just flapped her arms like a duck.
I couldn't think of the word duck. Wing. The wing.
Oh, got it.
I was having a moment, okay?
Is it
duck or is it quail? I don't remember, but whatever the bird is.
Duck, because the duck is bigger. Quail are like not even worthwhile.
Quail would be if you know Shayla Chase.
Oh, yeah. I have another pairing. This one is significantly more accessible than a hard-to-find French wine. So, taking a note from several of the bookstores and book clubs that Stacy visited, if you follow her on Instagram, she also shared a lot of these cocktails. We're doing just a classic espresso martini. This recipe is from the Preppy Kitchen. It's pretty standard across the board. You're not really going to find a lot of fantastic little hacks. I have two that I'm going to share, but essentially your espresso martini is 2 ounces of vodka. I love Tito's and Cathead. Those are just really great. They're smaller and they're just a better quality vodka to me than some of the other ones that you can get. So 2 ounces of vodka, 1/2 ounce of coffee liqueur, usually Kahlua, just get it. Or if there's like a local coffee liqueur or like a smaller batch, go with a smaller batch. But if it's like Kahlua or whatever mass produced other brand, Kahlua is solid. Just get it. 1 ounce of espresso, freshly brewed. Do not use powdered coffee. Don't do it. Instant coffee is a big no-no. Your drink will taste horrible. If you have to use just regular coffee, you can go to the grocery store and get like cold brew concentrate. Use that. Or even like pre-done cold brew coffee or pre-done espresso. I think you can get like a Starbucks in the grocery store. Like get that. It's so much better quality than your instant coffee. So don't do it. And 1/2 ounce of simple syrup. Garnish, the usual garnish is coffee beans. My hack is to use chocolate covered espresso beans just because they're more delicious. So how are we going to make this? If you're DIYing it at home, you're going to brew your espresso, let it cool completely, add ice to a cocktail shaker, then add your coffee, simple syrup, Kahlua, and vodka all in there. Shake it like a Polaroid picture. Shake what your mama gave you. Sing a song. Get that thing nice and cold. And you need to shake pretty hard and for a hot second because you want to have the foam. If you shake the Kahlua and the coffee, the espresso, it will foam. And that's what you kind of want, a little like crema on top, like a cup of espresso. You're going to strain it into a martini glass and then top with your coffee beans and serve. Another Lara hack, here's your second one, is if you are at home brewing your espresso in advance, use your extra coffee and pour it into an ice cube tray. And so when you shake your martini, you can shake it with espresso ice, not water ice. So you're not watering down your beverage and it'll be extra flavor. And then garnish with your 3 coffee beans or the Laura Antoun hack of chocolate covered espresso beans. And a very fun fact, I have one. What do the 3 coffee beans on the top of your espresso martini, which it is not an actual martini, everyone, we know, don't add us, it's called a martini but it's not technically a martini because it has no vermouth and no gin. So the 3 coffee beans on the top are traditionally a garnish of Sambuca in Italy called the La Mosca, the fly. It is meant to represent health, wealth, and happiness, which I can drink to that.
So this is kind of like the New Year's meal where you have the pork, the black-eyed peas, and the cabbage to bring you good juju and the things that those mean in the New Year, but this is in espresso beans.
And something else, yeah.
Yeah, money, wealth, and health, or money, health, and probably happiness. Good luck.
So yeah, this is health, wealth, and happiness, you can just drink an espresso martini instead of having an entire home cooked meal. And those are my pairings.
I love that. I can't say definitively that I remember having a Sincere. So I'm going to have to think about that next time I go out and get a glass. Just because that's not generally where I go. I'm going to try it.
I actually really love them with, like, I know that they're a French wine, but they're really, really good with, like, a pasta dish or something that has, like, a lot of complex flavors, like a really complex salad. It is a Sauvignon Blanc, so it's going to be, it's a white, but, you know, it holds up really well. It's a big flavor.
Well, I look forward to it. So I guess that segues us into the plot synopsis of All of the Dangerous Things by Stacey Willingham. I pulled the one from Kirkus Reviews because if you do like a glance at Amazon, Goodreads, a lot of them are very just generic glossed over. And then The other ones are like detailed to like she took a breath on page 5. So this is kind of a good down through the middle, and then we'll ruin it a little bit for you. A bereaved mother's year of sleepless nights is turned even more dire by percolating revelations about her past and present. Isabel Drake. Huh?
Percolating, like coffee.
Like coffee.
Anyway.
Isabel Drake is a lifestyle reporter for The Grit who turned freelancer so that she could marry Grit publisher Ben Drake without raising too many eyebrows. Hasn't slept through the night since her 18-month-old son, Mason, was snatched from his crib as his parents snoozed a few yards away. She's been so tireless in pursuing leads, even breaking the nose of a supermarket cashier, she suddenly learned how to record that Detective Arthur Dozier of Savannah Police Department has turned her out and warned her off the case. Exhausted from touring true crime conventions across the regions, publicizing the tale of her lost boy and the breakup of her marriage that followed, Isabel agrees to tell her story at length to a podcaster, Waylon Spencer, so that he can spread it more widely while she searches for sleep. But his questions are so unsettling that she begins to wonder if she was the one responsible for Mason's disappearance and what her role might have been in a family calamity more than 20 years earlier that was likely papered over because her father was a South Carolina congressman from a long line of congressmen. The windup is anything but tidy, for the multiple mysteries end up requiring multiple culprits. No matter, Willingham is so relentless in linking Isabel's sleeplessness to her deepening sense of waking nightmare that fans can expect some seriously sleepless nights themselves. People love violence from a distance, reflects the protagonist. This one's for readers who can love it up close.
Nice.
I thought that was a really solid one. So essentially from there, I'll start with the story of her sister. Her sister is drowned, and Isabel has always had trouble with sleep, and she feels like it may have been something to do with her, that she could have caused it, because she's told to a bit essentially say she didn't know what happened, she knows nothing, not act weird, not answer questions. We find out that it is actually the mother that killed her younger sister because she was suffering from postpartum depression, or not postpartum, but a psychological break after the death of one of her children. And Isabel didn't even really remember that child. Then we find out that Isabel's husband, Ben, is seeing a new woman named Valerie, and Isabel starts getting the inkling that maybe her husband has something to do with it. We find out, or Valerie, and we find out that Waylon Spencer, the podcaster, his sister, was the first wife of Ben, and she died. Then he shortly marries Isabel after that. They have a child. He didn't really want a child. He has been having an affair with Valerie. Ends up that Valerie. Which
revelation is insanity.
It's insanity. Turns out that Ben and Valerie give their son Mason to a woman that is unable to bear children or has lost a child. I can't remember the specific on that one. Yeah. Then Isabel goes to confront Valerie to find out her involvement in it. And she ends up pushing her and Valerie dies. But Isabel pins it on Ben as part like of a lover's quarrel, going to come clean, things like that. Isabel gets her son back and her husband's in jail.
And Ben's in prison.
And then Waylon gets justice for Ben killing his sister, his ex-wife, or not ex-wife, previous wife.
Which they even talk about that too, is that like, it wasn't even like, he doesn't, and that's the big thing, is like, he isn't directly responsible for anything. He just like manipulated her and like manipulated her emotions so much that she like took her own life. Yeah. And that's just like the amount of POS a person would have to be. It's like, at that point, just get a divorce.
Yeah, just get out. Get a
divorce. And like, I don't know, with all of it, it's just wild. But then again, he was a serial cheater anyway, so. We discover he was a serial cheater anyway, so.
Now, it was a wild, wild book, and I really enjoyed Flicker in the Dark, but as I've told Stacey, I think that this book is exponentially better, like wildly fabulous.
Yeah, I definitely think for her sophomore novel to see the growth from last year's book to this year's book is immense. Mm-hmm. And I think that it is just such a good story. The pacing is beautiful. I loved it. I thought it was really, really good. And it's one of those things where you just like every page, there's a new mystery, there's something else coming, and it unravels at the end in such a way where you don't feel like, oh, I only have 4 chapters left, I have to hurry up and unravel this knot. Like I need to tell everybody how it happens. So I just really enjoyed this book, and I really enjoyed our interview with her.
So let's stop procrastinating or postponing. Let's get to it.
Yeah, you guys enjoy our fantastic interview with Stacey Willingham. All right, well, hello. Welcome to Decanterbury Tales.
And we are graced with Stacey Willingham for the second time to discuss her new book, All the Dangerous Things. Welcome back, Stacey.
So much for having me. I can't believe it's been a year since the last time.
I know. It's been, feels like no time, but feels like a lot of time.
I know.
And congrats. You are the only person we've had on twice.
Nice. I like that.
No. You're racking up points in our books.
Yeah. Maybe we can make it 3 times next year.
Holding you to
it. There we go. So the last time we talked, you had just released your first novel. How has that last year been for you?
Oh, man. It's insane. It's been a crazy year. So, yeah, last time we talked, I guess, was January in 2022, and A Flicker in the Dark came out the first, second week of January. And so, yeah, since then, it's been nuts. I think I did about 80 events in 2022. Yes, some of them virtual, but a lot of them in person. Yeah, so it averaged out to like an event every 2 or 3 days for the whole year, which was crazy. Yeah, so I got to travel all over the place. I got to meet all kinds of readers and podcasters and journalists and things like that. And then it kind of died down a little bit over the fall while I wrapped up All the Dangerous Things, and then it kicked back up again this year. I just got back from my All the Dangerous Things tour a couple weeks ago. So
whoop, whoop. It's been really fun watching you from Instagram, you know, from afar, just seeing all of the cool places you've been, all of the response, the accolades, like,
oh, thank you.
Like, I would be like, pinch me. That's amazing.
Yeah, it definitely feels like that. It's cool because I get to meet online, I see all these like really cool bookstores all over the country, and like these bookstagrammers and podcasters and all these readers that I get to kind of meet online. But then when I get to travel for tour, I then meet them in person and I get to actually visit these bookstores in person. And so that's really cool. I mean, I got to go in January to like Murder by the Book in Texas and Poison Pen in Scottsdale and the Mysterious Bookshop up in New York. I was there a couple months ago, just these like famous bookstores that I'm getting to do events at in person now, which is super, super fun.
No, that's beyond cool. And I mean, it's amazing that you got to do everything for Flicker in the Dark, and now you're doing it for All the Dangerous Things. This is your sophomore novel. So what lessons did you learn from A Flicker in the Dark that you brought with you into the second book?
Ooh, that's a good question. So the first one that comes to mind, and I'm still learning this lesson, I definitely haven't mastered it, is Dark, when you're gearing up for your debut to come out, you're so scared of what the reception is going to be. And I think in a way that never goes away, because of course I was afraid of the reception for All the Dangerous Things. I'm already, you know, thinking about the reception for my third book that I'm not even done with yet. But with gearing up for A Flicker in the Dark's publication, I was like refreshing Goodreads like literally 10 times a day, like looking at the reviews all the time, just because I wanted to know, like, what are people saying? What are people thinking? And I've slowly started to learn that nothing good comes of that. So I've gotten a lot better this time around with not worrying about that stuff. I mean, of course, in some sense, I worry about it, but I didn't read the reviews this time around. I don't really check obsessively anymore. And that has been helpful, because anytime with Flickr, when I kind of like fell into a weak moment and read a bad review or something like that, it would affect my writing and my productivity for like several days afterwards, inevitably. So now I don't really know. I mean, I get the sense that people are enjoying it. I mean, I get tagged in a lot of really great things. I get a lot of really good emails and messages and stuff, but I don't read the reviews. So if people, you know, if there's bad things that people are saying, I will just remain blissfully unaware of it. And I'm happy with that.
Well, there are no bad things out there.
Okay, that's so good.
Yeah, you're not in your assumption.
Like, you've also become like my subtle flex. We have done a couple of smaller like book club meetups, or I've met a couple other bookstagram accounts that are close to me, and they were like, "Oh, well, have you read anything by Stacey Willingham?" And I was like, "Actually, I talked to her. I talked to her again." So you've become my flex.
Nice. I like that.
But additionally, did you intend for the covers of your two novels to look so pretty next to each other? They're unrelated stories, but the cover artwork suggests that they belong together.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, that was definitely intentional. You definitely think about how your books are going to look together, even though they're not related. It has to do with build your brand. Like, you want people to see your book and be like, "Oh, that looks like a Stacey Willingham book," you know? And that's not to say that every book will have that feel. Like, thinking about my third one, I'm not quite sure how we're gonna design that one just yet. But these two books have enough similarities that it kind of made sense to me. Like, they're both set in the South. They both have some really you know, I mean, A Flicker in the Dark has that like swampy nighttime in the woods imagery, whereas All the Dangerous Things is like a marsh with the Spanish moss and all the different foliage and stuff like that. So yeah, it was definitely intentional. And there's a couple other authors that do that really well. One that comes to mind is Rachel Hawkins. I don't know if you guys have read any of her work, but her three thrillers, the covers are so stunning next to each other. Like, you can see one of them and you just know it's a Rachel Hawkins book. So I kind of love it when authors have some cohesion among their covers like that.
I feel like Emily Henry's novels do the same thing too.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's anything from like the colors that they use, or like the type. I mean, the font for Flicker and All the Dangerous Things is the same. So even just little small things like that, I think, go a long way in tying them together.
So now that we've discussed the cover, we must discuss the title.
Yeah.
And so the inspiration is found in chapter 16 I feel suddenly exposed here in my home. Like Waylon is not only looking at me, but through me, seeing all the dark and dangerous things coiled up inside me. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose that as the title?
Oh, good. Another good question. The title, and I'm impressed that you found the little line of inspiration, because obviously it's,
did she find annotated. It? She was nice. Like, I remember.
Yeah, this is the first like, book I it. Have ever annotated, and I'm so proud of me. I was like, it's the title.
Because yeah, A Flicker in the Dark was a little more on the nose. I mean, there's a line at the very end that says ... like a flicker in the dark ... you know, so it's right there. With this one, the line was all the dark and dangerous things, which was what I first proposed as the title, but it felt very long, which sometimes long titles are not a big deal, but it felt just a little too long, too much of a mouthful, so we cut it down to all the dangerous things. And yeah, there's a couple reasons we went with that, mostly because the to do with, you know, at first there's all the dangerous things. Isabel talks a lot about all the dangerous things that happen like at night when the world is asleep, and we kind of don't stop to wonder like what's going on. When we fall asleep and we're unconscious, we kind of just assume the world is too, but there's all kinds of dangerous things that happen out there that we're not even really aware of. But then there's all the dangerous things that's taking place like inside of ourselves as well. Sometimes we're, you know, aware of them, sometimes we're not aware of them. So that was kind of a play on that idea. But what's interesting is my titles have been changed. So if you want to know the original title that we ended up changing, yeah, when I wrote All the Dangerous Things, it was actually called Hush Little Baby. Mm. Which I think is a pretty interesting title. It, you know, it played on the idea of, you know, a little baby and like this nighttime nursery rhyme. I thought it was very like The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, just kind of a little creepy, but there are a few other books out there titled Hush Little Baby. So we didn't think it was quite different enough. And I don't think the art would have worked quite as well with title. So I think we made the right call.
I feel you. Mm-hmm. That would have been a little strange juxtaposition.
Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have tied in quite as well. Yeah.
All right. We're going to switch slightly to some nitty gritty questions. And this is a longish question. It's at the end.
Okay.
So I found this in my annotating. I put everything is fine. All caps. The word fine, I'm fine, she's fine, it's fine, he, she, they're fine, comes up again and again. And Isabel states again and again that people don't actually want to know how she is. And her immediate response is constantly, I'm fine. And even with her parents sweep her mother's depression under the rug with a, she's fine, with the murder of her sister. It's fine. We're fine. The family is fine. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. And everything will be fine, but it's not fine. And we all want to be socially acceptable in our responses, but in saying I'm fine, these women are hurting themselves by not being honest and asking for help when they really need it. Do you think that Isabel's response to the loss of her son would have been different if she had known the truth about her mother and her sister?
Ooh. That is a good question. Let me think on that for a second. I absolutely do think so, yes, because I feel like what Isabel's family is one of those families that they say, I'm fine. They sweep things under the rug. They don't talk about their problems. And because of that, Isabel grew up knowing that something was wrong, something bad happened, but she didn't know what, and she didn't really feel like she could ask, and her parents never really wanted to talk about it. She just has this one memory of her sister sleepwalking and saying, it scares me when you do that. You know what I mean? And so as a little girl, Isabel like knows like something happened to her, something bad. You know, my mom wouldn't look at me or touch me after that. My dad was clearly covering things up. You know, my little sister was afraid of me, and then she dies. And so I think her family was one of those families that did just like sweep over their emotions, and they didn't openly talk about things. Isabel grew up with this guilt because she assumed you know, she must have had something to do with it, and no one ever told her otherwise because no one ever told her what happened. And so then when something bad happens to her son, who in a lot of ways, Margaret, she took care of Margaret like she, you know, she was her own, right? Like they were sisters, but Margaret was always following her around. Isabel was always taking care of her. And so when Isabel has like a son now who's in her care and something bad happens to him, that guilt just kind of comes raging back. And so I feel like if she knew what really happened to Margaret, that guilt wouldn't have been festering throughout her entire life, you know? And maybe she would have been able to look at it, I want to say more logically, because I feel like if something that traumatic happens to you, I don't know if it's possible to look at it logically, but maybe she wouldn't be so hard on herself. And it wouldn't be so easy for her to absorb everyone else's blame, because when she finds herself kind of thrust into this spotlight of everyone kind of saying like, how did you not wake up? How did you not know what happened? Like how, like kind of blaming her. And then with this, you know, 20 plus years of feeling guilty and blaming herself for something that happened to her sister, she just automatically picks up that blame again when it comes to her son.
I'm processing that one. Sorry.
Yeah.
No, that was wild. And I felt bad for her the whole time that she's just internalizing everything. Because I remember when I was in college, my roommate, who I love dearly and is still one of my best friends, she said, Georgiana, when people ask you how you are, they don't really want to know. They don't care. They just want you to say, I'm fine, and walk away. But, and that's exactly what came into my mind with this is like, well, what if she had just said, I'm not fine?
Yeah.
I'm fine.
Yeah, I know. And that is so, I mean, you think about when people, it's typically if people aren't fine and they try to say what's on their mind, they're not really met, it makes people uncomfortable. You know what I mean? They're not really met with like, oh, tell me more about that. How can I help? People just kind of like shy away from it. And so she doesn't ever feel empowered to actually what's going on. I mean, even in that scene near the end of the book, when she goes back to visit her parents and she's like trying to bring it up and her parents still keep shutting her down. Like, don't talk about it. Why do you want to talk about this? Don't keep dragging this back up, you know? And unfortunately there are a lot of people and families that are like that, where they just, there's, you know, issues festering, but no one ever talks about it. So they never get resolved.
My family's the complete opposite. We like to belabor a point until it's...
Oh my God. Mine too. We do have the opposite problem. We talk for like, we just talk things to death to the point where like, all right, there's no, this, we beat this topic to death. Like, we need to move on.
Yeah. Same. So speaking about beating things to death, somewhat, you are the queen of the simile.
Oh yeah. Thanks. No.
Lara was underlining similes in your book, and they're incredibly descriptive and full of emotion. Her emotions were scribbled between the lines of her face, like notes on a scrap of loose leaf paper, like late night lovers who forgot each other's names. Her voice like silk that's starting to tear, like a deer on the wrong side of two headlights barreling fast. Where do you find the inspiration for these?
Oh man, that's a good question. They kind of, this is a horrible answer, but they kind of just come to me. I mean, I don't know. I like descriptive writing. Like, I just really love finding ways to describe things in a way that's different and thought provoking and like kind of poetic. And so typically when, and to me, I guess I love writing books, I enjoy the plot and I enjoy like coming up with twists, but what I really love is just losing myself in the writing. Like, I find that very cathartic. And when I'm writing the long descriptive passages like that, and the similes and the alliteration, like that's what I really enjoy. So I feel like I can't really give a good answer to that, because I don't quite know where they come from, other than just like I see the descriptions I'm writing in my head very vividly. And so I just write down kind of what's coming to mind. I also read a lot, which I think always helps, because, you know, when you read other other authors writing and you get inspired by the way they describe something or they use a word in a way that you've never thought of before, that like kind of jars something loose in you to start thinking about words and scenarios in a different way. So I just try to stay creative with my writing and kind of push the envelope, like try to describe things in a way that's different or a little unusual and see how it works. And then always read other people's work that inspires me, because that, you know, helps the words keep flowing. I also love alliteration. I love the simile and I love alliteration, if you haven't noticed.
We'll pick that up in book three, is the alliteration. Mm-hmm. We'll
move yeah, on. There's a lot of it.
And I'm going to pay you a huge compliment. You sound very Taylor Swift right now.
Really? Has she said the same thing?
She's very descriptive in how she writes and trying to figure out different ways to explain like emotions and feelings that aren't just like, oh, I'm sad. And so it's that, like, I'm a glass case of emotion, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that I love that, because I actually, Taylor Swift, I have, oh my God, people are so like torn about how they feel about her, but she is a poet. I mean, her lyrics are incredible. I sometimes just read her songs. I just read them because the lyrics are so good. And that's kind of how that's how I feel too, is just trying to find unique and relatable ways to describe things that everyone, you know, has seen or felt or processed, but describe it in a way that feels new.
Mm-hmm. No, we get it. We see it.
Thank you.
You muted yourself, Laura.
How about now?
There you go.
All right, cool. Yeah, my phone kicked me off and then kicked me back on the chat. So is it my turn?
It's your turn.
All right, podcast inspo. So of course we have to say, we know All the Dangerous Things was already fairly finished last year when we talked, but you know, we had to, why a podcast as Waylon's in Were We a Slut Inspo?
Oh, yeah. So I'm going to say yes. Of course you were an inspo. So podcast, I have always been so interested in like podcasting as a profession for a variety of reasons. But for one, I think, okay, so right now, like, how do I explain it? Right now, there's so many different out there, and some of them are branches of like newspapers, like the Washington Post has a bunch of podcasts, New York Times has podcasts, but a lot of times podcasts are truly just people who are interested in something and they want to pursue it, which means there's no barrier to entry and anyone can do it. And people who do true crime podcasts are kind of fascinating to me because they don't really need like the credentials of an investigator or a journalist. But that also means they don't have the same red tape that comes along with those other professions. So whereas if someone is investigating a crime, like with the police or with a major newspaper, they're going to hit roadblocks that like basically an armchair detective or like an amateur sleuth may not hit, because they can kind of skirt around the laws in a lot of ways that professionals can't. So I found that really interesting that anyone can start a podcast. All you really need is some recording equipment and like an interest in something. And because of that, you know who they are, you don't know their motivations, you don't know their background, you know? So I thought Waylon being a podcaster would be a really interesting angle, because one, he gives Isabel what she wants, which is the ability for her to get her story out into the world without having to get up on stage over and over and over again. I mean, she can tell it once and then just let the podcast do the work and it'll reach all these people. But two, she would have a hard time motivations, right? Like why does he want to help me with this case? Like what's his interest in it? Why do podcasters latch on to certain things and obsess over them, you know? And so, of course, as we come to learn by the end of the book, Waylon has a personal connection with this case, which is why he got into it. And that wouldn't be the case for like a journalist, you know, like a journalist at a newspaper, there would be a major conflict of interest with if they were investigating a case that they had a personal connection to. But with a podcaster, like you can kind of hide those motivations pretty well. So I thought that was really interesting. I also did a lot of research on podcasts that ended up having real life repercussions. The most obvious being like Serial and Adnan Syed getting out of prison. I mean, like you can truly track like who start a podcast and they kind of stick their fingers in all these little aspects of a case. And then years down the line, it can have like real consequences on the case. And a lot of times these podcasters are kind of just everyday citizens, you know? So I find that pretty fascinating.
Yeah. And then you also have people like Paul Holes and the Murder Squad who like actually solved legitimate cold cases.
Yeah.
And that's wild to me because he's literally like a podcaster.
Yeah, I know. I know. And Payne Lindsay made some pretty big strides. And I believe it was Payne Lindsay who did Up and Vanished. That's that the Tara Winstead case. And he correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's one of his. But he made some pretty big some actual dents in that case. And then there's one in Australia, I want to say it's called Teacher's Pet, but it was basically a cold case. Have you heard of it? It's it was a cold case where a woman went missing and this one man was like convinced that her husband did it, and so he started a podcast, and the husband's in jail, you know. So there's truly people that just kind of take it upon themselves to try and
vigilante justice.
Yeah, I know. And it can be really great, but it could also, on the flip side, it could go really wrong. So you just never know.
And a little bit of a follow-up question with that one is, why didn't Isabel just tell him his cover from the start, his involvement? Like, wouldn't that have been so much easier in the trust building phase of everything?
Wait, say that one more time.
Why didn't Waylon tell Isabel his cover from the start? Because if she had known his involvement, wouldn't that have been like easier for him to gain her trust?
Yeah, definitely. But also I think he didn't know how she would react to that. I mean, Isabel clearly still had some feelings towards Ben. And I don't think she was ever convinced of his having something to do with it until the evidence kind of became presented to her and she warmed up to it, you know? So I think there was definitely a risk in Waylon showing up and being like, hey, here's who I am. And your husband killed your son. You know, I mean, that she could potentially open up or she could potentially shut way down. So I think in my mind, he needed to establish himself, start to work on it, and kind of gain a feeling of what she truly thought happened. And if he started to get an inkling of her being open to a theory like that, then maybe he would share it with her, you know.
I'm trying to imagine just her just being like, what?
right, like that could go very, very wrong for him. That's something, you know, that would be very hard for her to stomach, like realizing that, you know, her husband do something to her son. That's a terrible realization to come to.
Well, speaking of Ben, now that we've brought him up, he's the literal worst.
He's the worst.
The worst. And we really hope you haven't had firsthand experience, but the physical matching attributes of partners, his manipulation, a serial cheater, you wrote a character that we were all happy to be framed for murder.
Yep, I know.
So how did you get the inspiration to write him, or is there a character that inspired him?
Oh man, no. So it's funny, what I always try to tell people is like, I take little bits and pieces of my life and put them into fiction. But there's no character that's like truly inspired by another character. But I will say, I'm going to keep it vague because I don't want to expose anyone, but I once worked with someone, a man who was very manipulative and very gaslighty. Mm-hmm. And parts of Ben were inspired by that, just kind of like things at work that I would deal with, you know? And so little bits of that were inspired by that person, but I don't know. I guess I'm trying to think. Interesting, because when I was writing the ending, sure, how the reader would feel about Ben being framed for something he didn't do. I was like, I mean, that's what everyone was saying. Is I was like, he's a bad enough person that I don't think people would dislike it, but also like he's going to jail for something he didn't do. But everyone I've talked to seems to be like, I mean, he deserves it. Like, even if he didn't do it, he deserves it.
Yeah, no, totally agree. We were totally fine with it. Mm-hmm. Go to jail for what
you felt like justice.
Totally, I totally think so too. Yeah, but no, he's a combination of, you know, bad traits in people I've known in real life, but also bad traits of celebrities and people I've read about in the news. He's the worst of all the worst people combined into one fake terrible person.
Yeah, congrats on creating a real monster, because he was.
Thank you.
Ugh. All right. We skipped around for a second. Okay, so the novel brings up a reoccurring theme of a mother's crushing guilt, which we did play upon a little bit in last month's episode, where we covered none of this would have happened if Prince were alive, because the mom has just like this overwhelming feelings of like societal pressures. And Isabel totally nails it with her musings. She says, and I'm not just talking about mom guilt, the secret society reserved for mothers that batters one single notion into our brains over and over again, that no matter what we do or how hard we try, we're doing it all wrong. And in your opinion, why are mothers specifically plagued with this feeling? And how does that play into or amplify Isabel's search for answers about her son?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's funny, I don't know if you read the author's note, but I talked a bit in the author's note at the back of the book about how I was a little afraid to write this book for a while, because I'm not a mother yet. And so I don't have the firsthand experience and feelings that mothers do have when it comes to that kind of thing, mom guilt and societal pressures and stuff. But I also feel like women in general, like the weight of motherhood is always there from the very beginning. And for some reason, women are just always feeling guilty. Like, we're always apologizing for something. We always feel like something's our fault. Even if we didn't do anything, we still feel that like we need to be the ones to fix it. And I think when I was writing this book, I started writing this when I was 29, and I had spent the last like 5 years or so watching a lot of my friends either decide like, am I gonna have, they either started having kids, or they decided to wait and not have kids for a while, or they didn't want kids at all, or they wanted to be stay-at-home moms, or they wanted to put their kids in daycare and go back to work. Like, there's so many different very highly personal choices. And they were making those choices, those decisions for themselves. And no matter what they chose, like in the eyes of society, it was wrong. And, you know, everyone had something to say, like, oh, you're going to be a stay-at-home mom? What a waste of potential. Or, oh, you're going to put your kids back to daycare while you go back to work? Like, they're never even going to know their own mother. They're going to get raised by a stranger. Like, oh, you don't want kids? That's not very maternal. Oh, you want kids more than anything? Don't you have career goals? Like, every was the wrong choice in the eyes of someone else, and that really irked me. So I felt like I spent years kind of watching that happen, my friends and my family members, and watching every mother I knew feel guilt over the decisions they made, you know, whether they sent them to daycare, or whether they stayed home, or whether they gave them a sibling, or whether they had a sibling and that means they couldn't give them enough attention. It's like the guilt was always there and so all-consuming. So I wanted to that, because it felt like such a universal experience, but also one that when I talked to someone about it, there was like a sense of shame, and people were kind of embarrassed to admit it. But then I was like, if every single mom I'm talking to feels this way, why is it like this embarrassing, shameful thing? You know, it's just like this this common feeling that all moms experience, but nobody really felt like they could talk about it for some reason. So,
because so that's fine. What,
yeah, exactly. Because they're fine. Because when people ask, they just say they're fine. So yeah, that's where that came from. And then you had a part two to that question, but it's slipping my mind.
I do have, cause I agree with you on that because I am a mom and
okay,
I had my son very young and everyone always asked me, when am I going to have another one?
Mm-hmm.
Not if, when, and I'm like, yeah, kind of never. And then it's like, well, doesn't he need a sibling? First of all, he does not need anything. Second of all, it's none of your business.
I know. It's no one's business, but it's everyone thinks it's their business. And you know, I'm 32 now, which is not that old, but I get questions all the time about when you're going to have kids, how are you going to juggle it when you're traveling so much? Are you going to stop going on tour? Like, and it's just like, oh my God, like it comes from everywhere.
It's none of your business.
I know.
But the second half of that question was, how does that feeling play into or amplify Isabel's search for answers about her son?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So, I mean, that definitely has a huge impact on Isabel searching for Mason because, you know, we talked about guilt earlier. In addition to the mom guilt that just comes with being a mother, she has been carrying guilt around since she was a little girl because of what happened to her sister. And so I think there's a part in the book that small, but I felt like was important to include when she's reading the article about her talk at True Crime Con, and she reads the comments, which this goes back to like my rule of never reading Goodreads reviews, like never read the comments of articles because they just show like the worst of humanity. And she's reading the comments where people are like, she's a baby killer, change my mind, she deserves it, like all these horrible things. And I just feel like when you're in position, first of all, statistically, when kids go missing, statistically, kids are kidnapped by someone they know. A family member or someone they know. So I do understand like the police honing in on her and Ben, like they have to look at that, right? But then when you add in the judgment of the entire world and you're already feeling guilty about like, how did I not know? How did I not wake up? Why didn't I check on him for another hour? Why, you know, all these, did I really lock the window? Did I close it? Why didn't I change the batteries in the baby monitor? Like you have all this internal guilt. And then when you're absorbing it from many other people, just day in and day out, of course, that's going to affect the way you view something. And I think that's that guilt is a huge reason why she starts to ultimately believe she may have had something to do with it.
So heavy.
Yeah, I know. My books are heavy. I know.
Your books are heavy. So we're moving on to the light questions now that we've like delved deep. Mm-hmm. So rarely in books do we get a type of wine, but this
book, like never.
Yes, never.
It's oh, really? White.
Yes. You gave us a glass of Sancerre.
I did.
A varietal. Thank you for that. And
it's all caps with exclamation points. I was like, we have.
In a flicker in the dark, I gave you a Merlot because I'm a Merlot drinker. And technically, I did at first have All the Dangerous Things have Merlot, but then I was like, I gotta give my girls like some variety. Like they need to drink more than Merlot, so I changed it.
Well, we appreciate it, and so we wanted to know: is Sancerre holding a special place in your heart?
I wish I could say yes, but it's truly just because I changed it from Merlot because that's usually what I drink.
So Merlot is still the favorite, tried and true.
Merlot is still the favorite. Yeah.
Okay.
I should mix it up though.
Sancerre's super hard to find at your like just random local wine store by the bottle. I've tried. So
really? Okay. Yeah. You know, I haven't seen a ton of it either.
It's on like fancy restaurant menus. But very difficult to find at like
your look at Isabel, so cultured
wine shop. Fancy.
Because obviously Laura and I are trying to pair a Sancerre for the book because it was mentioned. So and all of our wines are supposed to be less than $25. And that's
I wonder, do you do wine exclusively, or do you do cocktails too?
We do cocktails too.
I've been do every like event, bookstore event I've done for this book that has any kind of like cocktail paired with it, they've been doing caffeinated like espresso martinis and stuff like that.
Because I've been screenshotting them because they're funny.
They're really good. I mean, I've been so caffeinated on this bookstore because I'm doing these events at like 8 p.m. drinking espresso martinis, and yeah, they're great.
I do love a good espresso martini. Those are delicious. Mm-hmm. She also drinks a lot of red blends. There's at least like 3 mentions of a red blend or a red wine going on in the book. So I may have to switch it up, but I have been attempting to locate a Sincere, but
nothing with cocktail and a wine. You never know.
We'll just blow it out.
I love this. This is so interesting to me how, obviously I don't pick up on stuff like that, but that's great. I think in book 3 then, well, my third book is a dark academia. So they're all teenagers drinking like Bud Light and whiskey straight out of the bottle. So
some Evan Williams.
Like Everclear.
Yeah. A little bit different.
Wow. So somewhere between where we are now and our college lives,
pretty much
throw that in there.
Yeah, pretty much.
So Franzia out of the box, it is.
Oh God, I know. Except I was thinking like, what did I drink when I was in college? And now I'm like, you know what? College kids these days, I think they drink like seltzers. Mm-hmm. I'm like, that didn't even exist. Like White Claw, that didn't even exist when we were in college. So maybe I should have them drinking White Claws instead of like Natty Lights.
The teens of today have never had the joy of a Four Loko.
Oh God. Yeah.
Like that is what we got.
That is what we got. High school in
college. A Four Loko.
You just needed one Four Loko for the whole night.
Yep. You're done. There's a podcast I listen to where they jokingly have one of the hosts does what she calls a power claw. And it's a White Claw with like a shot, like a double shot of vodka in it, and calls it a power claw.
Oh man. Yeah, it's been a whole new world trying to write about college kids, because sometimes I forget I'm like 10 years removed from that, you know? And so I'm like, oh man, this is like kind of difficult writing about people who are, how old are they? Like 19. Mm-hmm. So that was not a short time ago.
The fact that if you go to buy liquor and you have a 19 in the beginning, they don't have to look at any of the numbers anymore because you're automatically over 21.
That's just sad. sad.
And aside from drinking, like working on a college campus, I'm like, it would have been like kicked out of class for wearing some of those outfits.
Oh yeah.
I'm seeing my age in myself. I'm like, what happened to good old Nike shorts and frat tees? Come on.
I know, oversized t-shirts.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was definitely more comfortable. I forgot that you work on a college campus. I should, I might have some questions for you with this next book. Okay.
We'll go to Kudu and have coffee.
Perfect. Sounds good.
We've asked you your favorite book and your favorite drink last year. Do you have any updates? Have you read anything since we last talked that has made it to the top? Any new drinks? And then I jokingly put a Negroni Spagliato with Prosecco.
With Prosecco in it? Ooh, stunning. Yeah.
It's stunning.
Okay, I can't remember what I said my favorite book. Do you remember what I said?
I didn't go back and listen to it. I'm gonna be real. I didn't do that much research.
I can't. So my favorite, I would say right now, my favorite drink is probably a gin gimlet. I've been really into the gin lately. So I've been enjoying that. And my favorite book, I'm gonna go with, not my favorite book of all time, but I'll say my favorite book that I've read in the past year since we've talked is probably The Cabin at the End of the World by Paul Tremblay. Read that? You're nodding. Like, no. Okay.
No, but I've heard of it and I want to read it.
It is. So it's been on my TBR for a while, but the movie just came out like 2 weeks ago. And I was like, okay, I have to read it before I see the movie. And I read it in a day. I read it in 24 hours. It's so thought provoking. It's so well written. It's so different. So I loved that. So that's definitely a new favorite. I love Notes on an Execution. I think I probably read that since I talked to you guys last. That's another favorite.
That's also on my TBR list.
It's incredible. You'll love it. Also, I'm looking at my bookcase right now. If We Were Villains by ML Rio is a really good dark academia book that I just read. It's about a bunch of students in a art school studying Shakespeare, and one of them dies, and there's so much Shakespeare like woven throughout the narrative, which if you're not into that kind of thing, I could see how it might be a little, it might bog down the story a bit, but it's I loved it. It's beautiful. It's really good.
Lara's a Shakespeare person.
Oh, you would love it.
I'm excited.
Definitely need to read it then. It's so good.
So our final question, updates. You've mentioned this third book, mm-hmm. and we've kind of alluded to it, but will you be a three-peat?
I'll be a three-peat. I would love to be a three-peat.
So tell us what this book is about that we're going to be discussing with you.
Yes, I know. I feel like I've been talking about it a lot because it's top of mind. I've been writing it all day. So yes, my third book will be out in 2024. I don't know exactly when yet. So I'll keep you posted on that, but sometime next year. And it's my my attempt at a dark academia book, basically about these four female roommates who all kind of revolve around this one ringleader named Lucy. And she's kind of an enigma. She's mysterious. She makes people a little uncomfortable, though no one can really put their finger on why. And they live in this house off campus, right next to a fraternity. And one day, one of the boys that lives in the fraternity house winds up murdered, and Lucy goes missing. And so the remaining three roommates are kind of thrust in the middle of this murder investigation, trying to understand what happened. Where's Lucy? And all of the downfall that comes from that fateful night. So that's my third book. I'm really excited about it. It's definitely the most different thing I've ever written. But it's a psychological thriller like the others, just featuring younger kids, which brings its own set of writing challenges.
I mean, I can't wait to read it because I'm currently reading.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. The It Girl by Ruth Ware. And, I'm invested in this like college murder moment that I'm having.
Let me know if you need recommendations, because I tend to read like in the genre of what I'm writing, just because I like to know what else is out there. So when I wrote A Flicker in the Dark, I was reading like all serial killer stories. When I wrote All the Dangerous Things, I was reading a lot of missing children stories. And I have read like 15 dark academia books in the past year, just because I want to make sure I'm not inadvertently like doing what's already been done. Mm-hmm. But a lot of my favorites are college campus thrillers. I've read a lot of good ones recently, so
I'll be reaching out.
Yeah, please do.
Your reading list sounds really, really happy.
Yeah, right. Yeah, just some light stuff, some light reading.
Light reading.
I should throw like a romance in there or something, lighten things up a little bit.
The new Emily Henry comes out in a little bit. Just throw that in the rotation, palette cleanse.
Nice. Okay.
Move forward.
Good idea.
I think that's it for my.
That's all we got. Anything else cool. You want people to know about your book?
Where to follow you? Where to find you?
Yeah, sure. So I am usually most active on Instagram. My handle is Stacey V. Willingham, but I'm also on Twitter at SV Willingham and Facebook at facebook.com/ Stacey Willingham author, I believe is my handle. And then you can also get my books and things like that at stacywillingham.com, but I'll be the first to admit I don't update it very regularly. So you'll probably just want to follow me on Instagram. I really hope you guys enjoyed it. I'm glad that you gave it a read and you invited me here today, and I hope you like the next one too.
I can't wait to read the next one. And
Thank
I'm
you.
Just going to say it. I think I liked All the Dangerous Things more.
Yay. That makes me happy.
Which is always scary with the second book, because you're like,
I know. They call it the second book scaries, the sophomore slump. There's all kinds of words. Like, people, the second book is hard. I mean, they're all hard. Now that I'm writing my third one, the third one's hard too. But the second one, there's just like a certain level of pressure there that you just don't know how it's going to land, especially since people seem to really enjoy A Flicker in the Dark. So I'm breathing a sigh of relief now that people seem to enjoy it.
I love to flicker in the dark, but like, you outdid yourself on this one. It was,
thank you,
top notch.
Thank you so much.
I mean, as,
and thank you for indulging me shooting my shot. If you ever need someone to read for a screen test.
Okay. Hey, I will keep you posted.
I was like, olive skin, dark hair, big eyeballs. I was like, Anna, like, mom, oh, I got some experience to pull from. Like, I was a major, let's go.
If we ever get optioned, I will call you up.
That's a question we didn't ask you about. Mm-hmm. How's the flicker in the dark optioning going?
I have no details on that, unfortunately. This stuff is so slow moving. So yeah, nothing there, no movement there right now. And then All the Dangerous Things is kind of floating around out there. Basically, the way it works is my film agent sends it to producers. So people are reading it, and we'll see if anything comes of it, but it hasn't been optioned just yet.
Well, whenever you see Emma Stone, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'll say that. Yeah. Okay, I will.
All right. Thank you so much, Stacey.
Thank you, Stacey. I'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
And we're back.
Stop. It was too good.
It was too good.
It was too good.
I thought you meant literally stop, and I was like, wait, why? What's happening?
No, stop in the, like, needed a minute. Really enjoyed that interview. I really enjoyed going to hear her talk about her book with another author. I don't know. I think that this, as I've said, this is
book reading meetup. That was anything that she didn't tell us on the show that would be interesting for those of us that weren't there. Not to put you on the spot or anything.
Let me think. She talked a lot about, there were a lot of questions about like the writing process. Okay. So this is actually, Flicker in the Dark was not her first book that she ever wrote. She wrote an entirely different novel before that book that was turned down by everyone. She was turned down over the course of the year by 125 agents that didn't want to sign her. And then she scrapped it, rewrote A Flicker in the Dark, or wrote A Flicker in the Dark. And eventually she found her place in that, which I thought was really interesting, because in our minds, or from what we see to the public, it was like all of a sudden Stacey is a household name for A Flicker in the Dark, for All the Dangerous Things. And it just kind of shows the behind the scenes of kind of the grit that has to get you to this point. She also mentioned the comment section and how she tries not to read good reviews, bad reviews. She just tries not to read any of them. And she was like, it's interesting. One person will write a positive comment, like, I love her similes and metaphors. And then somebody will write, stop using so many similes and metaphors. It's too much. And so she's like, there's really a balance in, for every good review, there's a bad review. But that's how she kind of got her inspiration for the comment section when Isabel scrolls down.
Oh, no.
She sees the woman write the comment, he's in a better place. And that's kind of where she got that idea.
That's very cool.
There's the thing, I'm really just kind of only thinking about, I think it's my best friend's exorcism. It may be another book. I'm thinking about something that Grady Hendrix said. And in one of his books, which I have to read, they are in a lab and they trip, the character trips over a bucket of fetuses and knocks it over. Well, true story, Grady was in a lab and he didn't knock it over, but there was like a bucket of fetuses that he like ran into, and luckily it didn't spill over. But that's how he put that in the book. And so they were kind of talking about like some things that are real, aren't real, things like that. Then like where the inspiration comes from. And sometimes it's like super literal like that. And so honestly, once a bucket of fetuses is put in a conversation,
there's really no going
really
back.
All you can think about.
Wow. All
sorry
right.
If that was too much, guys.
That's so Grady though. Wow. All right. And we decided we weren't going to do extra book club chat at the end. We just really loved our author interview and really kind of covered it all for us. But
it get really repetitive.
Yeah. So if you have something that you want to talk about that you wish that we had talked about, feel free to comment on the blog, send us a DM, send us an email. And yeah, we'd be happy to have more book club chit chat in the blog comments. Let's do it. Pop in the comment section. Let's go. You know, that's what it is. But this has been an episode of To Canterbury Tales.
And I guess before we should go, we should announce our March book.
Yes, which I am so excited. Our March book is
The Cloisters by Katie Hayes.
And we've already interviewed her because we're in a time machine and it's stinking good. So
it's good. It's another read with Jenna pick. Jenna picks good books, y'all. We can't fault her.
We can't. And
it's, oh guys, if y'all love The Lost Apothecary like we did,
dive in.
It's good. And it's got like the mystery thriller kind of a little bit of a vibe, but in a totally different light. So
oh, so good. You're just going to have to read and find out. And then you can tune into our March episode to hear our amazing interview with Katie Hayes, because it is so good.
Man, going really well for us, y'all.
I know.
We're loving it as much as we are.
Been great. So with that, y'all, we will see you next month. Bottoms up.
Stay weird.
And bye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Decanterbury Tales, a boozy book club podcast. If you've loved what you listened to, don't forget to write us a review. It is the best way to share the love. Enjoy our website, decanterburytales.com. Write us an email at decanterburypod@gmail.com. Check us out on Instagram @decanterburypod, Facebook, Decanterbury Tales, the podcast, and on Goodreads, Decanterbury Tales. Bottoms up and stay weird. Cheers!